Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete.
This week's episode is an encore of episode number 1308. For the first time in 6.5 years of doing Eyes on Success, we've had to resort to inserting an occasional encore presentation because we're in the throes of moving from one side of the country to the other, and we've gotten incredibly busy.
This week, we'll be talking about the evolution of speech synthesis technology and how speech synthesis has come to be as good as it is these days.
We'll speak with Andrew Breen, Director of Innovation for Text-to-Speech at Nuance Communications, about the history, the current technology, and future goals of speech synthesis. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Andrew Breen.
One of the things that we're keen on in Nuance and want to push for is the idea that it's our job to make this technology work for you as a user. So both in speech recognition and speech synthesis, our aim is to make this technology transparent. It should just work. So I wouldn't want to give advice about speak this way or sit that way. I'd hope that our technology speaks for itself.
And as we all know, speech synthesis has come a long way in the past few decades. Particularly in the past decade, there have been a lot of advances to make it sound fairly natural.
In fact, Pete and I used to have our computers and desks on opposite sides of the room, and it never used to bother me when his speech synthesizer was talking, because to me it just sounded like noise and it was easy to ignore. And then they made one too many improvements, and it sounded to me almost like there was a person on the other side of the room, and that was getting much harder to ignore. So I started complaining about how good it had gotten, but overall, even I recognize that this kind of improvement is really beneficial.
So we're going to learn today what makes this all possible, what some of the challenges are, and how it's all done.
Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll meet Andrew Breen. Can you start by introducing yourself?
Hello, my name is Andrew Breen, and I'm Director of Innovation for TTS at Nuance Communications.
And what does TTS mean?
TTS stands for Text to Speech.
Where are you located, and where is Nuance located?
I'm personally located in Norwich in the United Kingdom, but Nuance has offices all around the world. Our central office is in Boston, in the USA.
Most of our listeners have visual impairments. Do you have a visual impairment yourself?
I don't, no.
So we mostly wanted to talk about the history of speech synthesis and where it might be going in the future, but why don't you give us a little idea of what other things Nuance is involved in?
Well, Nuance is involved in many things to do with speech technologies, from speech recognition and speech synthesis. We have products such as Dragon Dictate, Dragon Naturally Speaking, and of course, we are now having things like Dragon Go and Dragon Search, which allow you to communicate with your mobile device and do a search on the internet. Nuance has many inroads into the medical arena, and we have companies such as Dictaphone that provide essential dictation services for the medical profession. We're also involved in the automotive space, and many of our applications are in automotive providers as well.
Can you give us some idea of about how large the company is?
The company is around about 8,000 people currently, and they're distributed in many regions around the world.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is the evolution of speech synthesis, starting from its very beginnings, a long time ago.
Speech synthesis has changed a whole lot over the past couple of decades, and I thought maybe you could give us a quick summary of where we started and some of the transitions and where we are now.
Sure. Well, actually, speech synthesis has a very long history. I mean, people have been trying to make machines speak way back into the 1600s. And many famous scientists have dabbled in speech synthesis throughout the years. But it's only really come to the fore in the late 50s and early 60s when people were developing machines, electronic machines, to produce synthetic sounds. UVA was one such machine that was developed by a Swedish institute back in the 60s. And then slowly we go into the 70s and 80s where the first text-to-speech systems appeared.
And what did people do before text-to-speech?
You had the electronic systems that would take a visual spectral representation of the speech to be spoken, and that would be passed through a machine, and it would read this spectral representation a bit like a pictorial graph of the sound, and then translate that pictorial graph into an auditory sound. These weren't text-to-speech machines as such. They constituted the last part of the process. It was only when we get to the text-to-speech systems in the late 70s, early 80s, with systems such as ClapTalk, where you actually have orthographic text being completely translated into synthetic speech.
And can you define orthographic?
Orthographic text is text as you would see it typically written on the page.
I'm kind of curious. You said that people tried this since the 1600s. What kind of ventures were those?
There are a number of competitions that people were asked to produce a speaking machine. This competition was won by von Kempelen's apparatus that could produce crude vowel sounds. And it had a combination of a bellows and a leather sort of cylindrical output device, which could be manipulated by somebody's hand into different shapes. And those shapes approximated the shapes of the human vocal tract. So in this way, by compressing the bellows and manipulating the leather cylinder at the end, you could sort of make crude vowel-like sounds.
Sure enough, a few years ago, somebody made a replica of von Kempelen's speaking machine and then proceeded to demonstrate it and put the video up on YouTube. And here's a little clip of some of the noises that von Kempelen's speaking machine replica is able to make. Fortunately, things have improved, but if you're intrigued about this speaking machine, it's quite a contraption. There's a big article in Wikipedia, and of course, we'll have the links to that in the show notes on our webpage. And if you want to hear other historical examples, you can go to Dennis Klatt's History of Speech Synthesis, and we'll have a link for that also. So I remember Pete's first speech synthesizer in the early 1980s, and frankly, it was pretty miserable. Even he couldn't understand what it said. Can you walk us through some of the major breakthroughs that have gotten from there to something that sounds nearly human today?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there have been some major differences between those early what are called formant synthesis systems and the current-day concatenative systems. So if we break the process of generating synthetic speech up into two parts, you have an analysis phase where you look at your text and you extract information from that text. So, for example, things like pronunciation. You have to convert the standard reading of text to the phoneme sequence, the phonics, that you're then going to make the sound through the synthesizer with. And there may be other information. You might want to use part of speech if you want to get some grammar in there. There are lots of different symbolic features that you might want to include to help you synthesize the sound. Obviously, you need to generate a pitch contour and a duration contour, so you've got to have the speech sounding with a particular intonation and lasting a particular length of time. These parameters are then pushed out into what's called the back end of the TTS system. And the back end is constructed through two general approaches. One approach is to model sounds, and the other approach is to store basic sounds and then select the closest approximation. So the older systems tended to use something around modeling. They would have a generic model of how a human being produces a sound, and they would either electronically, if it was a hardware device or in software, emulate the vocal tract through some model of production. So that's why they sounded synthetic, because you were trying to build a complete model of the human vocal tract system. Concatenative solutions are different. The best analogy when we think about concatenative systems is to think about a template of sounds. And if you imagine first a template of colors, so if when you look at your computer screen and you view a picture on your computer screen, that picture is made up of a finite set of colors that's drawn from the palette of colors that's available on your computer. Now, the modern day computers have millions of colors that they can choose from, but I'm old enough to remember when the first computers had very few colors, maybe even 16 or 32, and then went to a few thousand. But there are a finite number of colors that could be used. So in representing any image, the computer would have to select a particular color that matched to the desired picture. So if it was a seascape, it would choose a lot of blues. If it was a forest, it would choose a lot of greens. But it still only had a finite number. Now, when we talk about concatenative synthesis, it is the acoustic analogy. So we record a set of phrases that we believe are representative of sounds a human being is going to make. So these would be things like phonemes in context. So we would record phrases like, hello, how may I help you? And then we would chop these phrases up into their phonemic constituents. And these become the atomic elements of sounds that we would put in our template of sounds. When we want to synthesize something, we analyze our front end, we get our phonemic sequence out of the front end as a set of symbols, and then we try and find the sound that closest matches to the phonemic. So we take the output of our front end, which is a symbolic sequence of phonemic symbols and other features that we want to select against, and then we use these features to index into a palette of sounds. And we pull back the sounds that are the closest to what our features tell us we should be looking for. So when we build a system, we try and, within a finite space, get a good distribution of sounds. We can't store every sound that a human being can make. We can only store a relatively sparse number of sounds. So the game is to try and find a good representation of sounds that will fit into our computers, and then find an algorithm that will take a set of features and match it to the closest approximation to the sound we want. Once we've found that sound, we pull out of our palette and we simply concatenate them together. And so we concatenate fragments of sound, the output of which sounds hopefully like a natural rendition of speech.
I know you make voices, for example, in English. This show isn't English, it's the language we speak, so we're going to keep using English as an example. And I know you have voices that do American English, British English, Australian English, Canadian English. Do you have an individual reading in basically the same set of phrases? So if I were to say, hello, how may I help you? That sounds differently from how you just said it. And then you capture the same units to concatenate together?
Absolutely right, yes. There are a lot of nuances to this, but typically we would have a basic set of scripts that for a language that we want to generate would give us a coverage of the sounds that we need to capture. And if you were to do a synthesis system or I were to do a synthesis system, we would say the same scripts. Now, there would be differences, obviously, in the way that sound is produced because your vocal tract is different from mine. But at a linguistic level, we will be using the same underlying linguistic rules. So as long as we stick to the same linguistic rules, then we can pull out a phonetic realization of those rules that is to a particular individual. So I'm going to assume that you're going to say potato, not potato. If you say potato, then we could pull potato back out and it would sound like you. And if we pulled it out for me, it would sound like me. So we have to make a difference between the linguistically meaningful sound and then that which produces character and color on top of that, the performance of that sound. When we index into sounds, we index the meaning. So we're looking for sounds at a meaning level. And we can also do it at maybe at a what's called a prosodic level. So we might find something at a particular pitch. So we might model your pitch as well. We allow the character of the individual to be encoded in that sound fragment.
So do you have different people that you have read these phrases for the different flavors of English or other languages, I presume?
Yes. So we would have individuals from every dialect read. So we would choose an artist to do the reading. And we would choose that individual based on maybe if it's a customer-specific solution, then the customer will say, I want this demographic. I want them to be young, bright, breezy style. Or they might say, no, I want this to be a professional, mature individual. So we might suggest a particular voice talent for those different demographics. Or the customer might say, no, I want this individual to be produced for a synthesis system. And we have to work with that. And these individuals would then do the recordings to the scripts that we produce, that we would then turn the handle and produce a TTS system, text-to-speech system, which will sound like that individual.
So can you talk a little bit about the process, how it gets started, how long it takes, how much these people have to read, what's involved?
Well, it can take quite a considerable length of time. We do like to go into a studio, make sure that the artist is comfortable with the environment and understands the script that they have to speak. We don't want to overstress a voice because we want the voice to sound the same from recording session to recording session. So we may limit in a day a recording session to be 1, 2, possibly 3 hours, but we may do successive days to cover all the script entries we want. And those script entries, depending on the product that we want to produce, could be in the thousands. So there could be thousands of phrases that are recorded to get the coverage of this palette of sounds that we're looking for. And if we have a particular customer, the customer might say, well, I want my palette to be more focused on my product. So we may actually go into the studio and record additional phrases that allow us to pull back sounds that are going to be more appropriate for their market. So we can tune the scripts to a particular market as well.
If there's specific vocabulary that's particular to your customer, you would have your voice talent actually read that vocabulary?
We can do that, yeah. I mean, obviously our aim and the thing about a text-to-speech system that is the value of the text-to-speech system, it can say anything. So you can write down any unseen text and it will say it. It could even be a made-up word and the text-to-speech system will say it. So our goal, of course, is to produce something that can say anything. But having said that, if we know that the TTS system is more likely to be saying things about toys, for example, then obviously it would make more sense to include words around that market. We can increase our palette of sounds in the regions that we want to focus on. An analogy would be, again, if we move to the computer graphics domain where you've got a palette of colors, if you have to paint a picture that could be anything from a forest to a seascape, then you have to make sure you've got good coverages of blues and greens. If you know you're only ever really going to be interested in seascapes, then you want to make sure that you've got a greater propensity of blues. And it's the same idea. If we know the domain in which the text-to-speech system is going to be working, then we can start to tune our sounds to that domain.
So it sounds like this recording session could take a week or several weeks, and then there's a lot of work that needs to be done afterwards to massage this into something you can actually use. Is that automated, or how long does this take? What has to be done afterwards?
Right. So once you've got your scripts recorded, you have to prepare them further. And the most immediate thing you have to do is, if you like, chop them up into their phonemic sound fragments. So this is called labeling, and it's a semi-automated process. In that respect, we can use Nuance's speech recognition technologies to provide a good estimate of where the beginning and end of a particular sound is in a word. But we may want to go in and find correct a boundary here and there to make sure that we get the right sound fragment if we wanted to pull it out and stick it together with another sound. So there's a combination of automation and maybe a hand correction as well that goes on top. Because, we are literally cutting out a sound fragment and sticking together with another sound fragment. So we have to be quite precise about where we align the boundary of one sound to the boundary of another.
And approximately how many languages do you support?
It's 50 plus.
So I assume you deal with all sorts of different alphabets. Do you also deal with non-alphabetic writing, like in Chinese and Japanese?
Yes, we do. We have to translate that representation into something that we can work with internally. And so that's what we do. As I was saying earlier, we work with these systems. The first thing we have to do is to understand how we can construct words out of the stream of symbols that is produced in Mandarin, for example. And then from this, we go to the next stage, would be doing a more traditional linguistic analysis on those words, and then going again to a phone set, which additionally would have potentially tones associated with it, so that we could start to build up our inventory, our template palette of sounds that we would then select against. So each language tends to have its own idiosyncrasy that we would have to look into.
So this question might not really be fair, because I know you're responsible for text-to-speech, but Nuance also has, as you described earlier, a bunch of products that do speech-to-text. Which one of those presents the bigger technical challenge?
Well, I think that would very much depend on which type of researcher you ask. They're both hugely challenging. The issue, obviously, with speech-to-text is that one is recognizing the words that somebody spoke. So that's, if you like, a machine transcriber. And beyond that, there's the extracting of the meaning. So we do both in Nuance. The speech recognition will transcribe, for example, a voicemail and give you a text based on that. And then when we go to search, we don't want to just use the words that the individual was saying to give back an immediate text interpretation of that. If we're doing a search like where is the nearest restaurant or how old is Barack Obama, we have to interpret the meaning from that speech and then pull back the information. So that's another layer upon speech recognition, that speech understanding. But both of those tasks are incredibly difficult. I mean, you've got an individual's way of producing a sound, which you have to try and recognize different accents and idiolects. You've got to try and recognize all the potential words that a human being can say. And so you have to try and predict the most likely words that would follow another word to try and constrain this space. It's a huge, complex problem. But equally in synthesis, moving beyond the simple production of a sequence of sounds, if you want to intone that and provide meaning, provide style and character, then equally you have to try and understand what the author of the text was trying to convey in terms of the meaning. And that, again, is a very complex and difficult problem. So taking them to the next layer, to the layer of that which is approaching human performance, is challenging whichever topic you look at.
Now for this week's high-tech topic, where speech synthesis is going in the future.
So speech synthesis has really improved over the years, and some of the newer ones certainly sound pretty realistic. What are the challenges that are coming up next in terms of speech synthesis? Where do you guys see the future?
So the future is around expressivity. The systems as we produce them now are designed to produce intelligible speech in the most natural manner. What we would like to be able to do is provide a sense of modeling a particular style. So a more expressive reading in a news report, for example, we would like to be able to model in a characteristic newsreader. In a sports report in America, they are very energetic in the way they speak, and we would like to be able to model that. If, for example, we want to have a book reading application, we would like to be able to intone the synthetic speech with a little bit more character and color than we are currently able to do. That is the road that we're going now. We're constantly pushing the boundaries of what we can achieve in terms of expressivity.
And is the barrier there our understanding or processing power on our portable devices or what?
It's both of those. It's actually understanding what information we need to draw from the text. And that information isn't necessarily transparent in the text. If you're talking about a news item, depending on the words, for example, if it's a car crash, then that will carry with it a particular emotional response that the newsreader will be sensitive to as a human being. So we'd have to try and start to think about how we would model an appropriate emotional response to a given text. That means that we have to understand at a much deeper level what is written in the text. So it's a much greater interpretation. That obviously requires a much more computer power and algorithmic power to do. So that's the challenge there. But if we want to put it on a device, we will be challenged to do that because we'll be looking at a greater computational load to do that. But there's also another element to this, and that's our ability to be able to find the sounds in our palette of sounds. If you remember, we have only got a finite set of sounds. The more expressive we want to be, the more we're challenging our palate to be able to find an approximation. So that task of finding a close approximation becomes much more difficult. Now, one way to solve that would be to take ourselves all the way back to the early days of speech synthesis and look at models of speech. Try to model a human vocal tract again, where if we model a vocal tract, we can model anything. You know, we can make the sounds that the vocal tract is potentially capable of making. So we're not limited in the sounds. But then we are back to the problem, how natural can we make those models? There has been a lot of progress in this. There is still a gap between the naturalness that we can achieve through a model-based approach and the performance of segmental quality, the actual sounds that we can get back from a concatenative solution. But that gap is narrowing. There are other advantages, of course, going with a modeled approach. In a concatenative solution, of course, we have to store all these sounds. That's going to take a lot of computational real estate. We have to put the sounds somewhere to select them out. If we model the sounds, if I, for example, recorded myself saying the sound "ah" in 50 different ways, then I could start to build up a model of what is the characteristic way I would say "ah." And then having got that characteristic way, I could build a model to reproduce that sound. So then, instead of having to store all those 50 examples, only to store the parameters needed to produce the one characteristic example. So there's a huge saving in terms of footprint when we go to a model-based approach. And many of the very small systems, the systems on the lower-end handsets and mobile devices, are model-based.
If you want any more information about Nuance, you can go to their website, which is www.nuance.com. And that's spelled N-U-A-N-C-E. And they've got information about their products and, of course, employment opportunities and lots of great other information.
Well, that was certainly very educational. We learned a lot about how speech synthesis is made and why they keep on improving.
And how they made some of those improvements.
They certainly are a lot better than that Von Kempelen machine that we heard earlier in the show.
If you missed any of the links we've given, they're all in the show notes, which you can find at our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. That's it for show number 1717. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the Helen Keller Archives. Helen Selsden is the chief archivist for the American Foundation for the Blind. She joined the AFB in 2002 to organize and preserve the Helen Keller Archives. We'll speak with her about her work and about this rich source of information on the history of visual impairment, women's history, literary history, and American culture. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-210-8094.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.